This is a special broadcast of the 2009 Council of Conservative Citizens Conference in Jackson, Mississippi. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Radio Network, the Council of Conservative Citizens, and the dedicated service of Jamie Kelso. This is the speech by Jared Taylor.
Well, Leonard, thank you so much for that very kind introduction. It's always a real pleasure and an honor to speak to the Council of Conservative Citizens. I was just now trying to think to myself when it was the first time I spoke to a meeting like this. And I certainly don't go back to 1955 the way Leonard does. But I believe the first time was about 15 years ago in Franklin, Tennessee. And I had never heard of the Council of Conservative Citizens before that. And that meeting, I said to myself, this is where I belong. These are people who think straight, and it's a great group to join. And I have never wavered in that conviction. I've tried to speak to as many meetings of this kind as I possibly can. Well, my talk today, I suppose if it had a title, it could be something like Science and Conservatism, or Science and Racial Consciousness. And if it were to have a subtitle, it would be something like The scientists have finally figured out that everything your granddaddy told you was right after all. I believe it's something like the trickle-up theory of good sense, that eventually wisdom and understanding eventually will trickle up from people like us to the intellectuals and the scientists. They're finally beginning to see what's been staring them in the face all along. The fact is, our ancestors had no doubts about many things that are now considered to be called into question or dubious or even wrong. They had no doubt that race was a significant biological category, that it wasn't some sort of sociological optical illusion, that race was an important part of an individual or group identity, that different races built different kinds of societies, and they preferred the society that their people built. They took it for granted that they wanted their grandchildren to look like their grandparents, not like Anwar Sadat or Fu Manchu or Whoopi Goldberg. And they assumed that their descendants were going to live forever in a country that was characterized by their people, their culture, and their history. Now, of course, the myth in the United States today, the one to which we are all supposed to bow down to, is that diversity is a wonderful thing, that if you gather people from all around the world who are not only as unlike us as possible, but as unlike each other as possible, that that's going to be a superb advantage for America. The theory is you could almost state it without too much exaggeration as if you took you took a couple of Asians and a couple of Hispanics and some blacks and maybe a few lonely white people and put them in a room together and maybe added for even more diversity a sprinkling of nudists and lesbians and what all, that in about 15 minutes they'd probably invent a cure for cancer and the next generation of the iPod. Diversity is such a strength. Well, as our ancestors understood perfectly, and as the scientists are slowly beginning to figure out, nature does not like diversity. Nature prefers the ties of kinship. And I'll start with frogs. Frogs lay their eggs in a bunch. Well, if you take the bunches of eggs of several frogs, and you let them all hatch together, mix them all up, and they hatch together in a big pan, by the time the tadpoles hatch, the tadpoles that are from the same mother, they somehow can figure who each other are out. They can figure out who are their brothers and sisters, and they congregate together in their own little area of the pan. They can tell who they're related to, and they prefer being around their kinfolk. Even bees know who their kinfolk are. In one experiment, they took bees from a particular hive, and they bred them very carefully to produce 14 different degrees of relatedness, from full sister all the way out to 13th cousins. And once they had this mix of bees, they released them back to the ancestral hive. Well, all bees, all hives have guard bees that make sure that only the right sort of bees get into the hive. And these guard bees, they could tell who were their kinfolk and who were not. And your chances of getting into the hive were almost perfectly correlated with how related you were to the bees that were already in the hive. Even plants, believe it or not, can figure out who they're kinfolk to. If you take plants, different kinds of plants, and put them in the same pot, they are aware that there is a competing plant in that same pot. And so what they tend to do is they grow their roots out more vigorously and more branches to try to compete for the nourishment that is in the pot. Now, that's an inefficient way for the plant to operate. It puts more energy into roots than it should for ideal growing purposes, but it figures, oh, there's a competitor over there, I better get mine. Well, if you take plants of the species called a sea rocket, and they are plants that are descended from the same mother plant, so to speak, seeds from the same plant, they will somehow recognize that here is a brother or a sister, and they will not compete. They will grow normally and cooperate. Nobody knows how they can tell. But nature prefers to recognize kinship and appreciates kinship. When you move up into animals, chimpanzees, for example, they're said to be our closest relatives in terms of genetic closeness. They're extremely tribal. If you have a tribe or a group of chimpanzees and you have somebody else from another tribe that wanders in, they will chase them out immediately. They'll even kill the young chimpanzees from that other tribe. Not only the males do this, but the females do this. They have a very, very firm sense of territoriality, as do human beings. There is something known as a genetic similarity theory that explains a lot about how human beings behave. And as it turns out, when people choose their spouses or even their best friends, they tend to end up with people that are very genetically similar to each other, not just in appearance and makeup, but even in terms of level of intelligence, interests, hobbies, personality, and even in terms of undesirable characteristics. People who are aggressive or alcoholics or crime-prone, they tend to end up together, too. In fact, according to one study, a very easy way to draw some sort of conclusion as to how happy a married couple is to be, you don't even have to meet them. All you need to know is a scientific assessment of how similar they are in terms of personality traits, just how close they are genetically. The closer they are, the more likely they are to get along and be happy together. Now, this attraction to people who are our kinfolk, who are similar to us, can be found in the fact that a preschool-age child who lives in a household where there is at least one adult that is not that child's parent or biological relative or uncle or something like that is 40 times more likely to be assaulted than a child that lives in a household with parents. The fact that the child is not related to an adult, that exposes that child to a 40 times greater likelihood of physical assault. We are kind to our kin, and we know who our kin are. In the same, in a similar manner, people who are married to someone of a different race, spousal homicide, in other words, a spouse killing another spouse, is 7 times greater in mixed couples than in couples where you're married to someone of the same race. Now, your granddaddy may not have known that particular figure of 7 times, but he didn't have to know that to give you good advice about who you ought to marry. Another interesting thing about what scientists are discovering about race. If you show experimental subjects 10 photographs of black faces and 10 photographs of white faces, and you tell them, okay, you study those faces, try to remember those faces. Then you take away those photographs, and then you mix them in with 20 more black faces and 20 more white faces, and you give them back to the subject, and you say, okay, which are the ones that you saw previously? White people are much better at determining which were the white faces they saw, and they're not nearly so good at determining which were the black faces they saw. So the scientists have, in effect, proven that, well, in some sense, they do look all alike. Now, before you laugh, it works exactly the same way with blacks. You show black subjects black faces and white faces, And the ones that they remember best are the black faces. They get confused on the white face. They forget which were the white faces they saw before. Now, this is such a well-known phenomenon that the scientists even have a race, have a name for it. It's called the other race effect. And this other race effect is even evident in children 3 months old. And the way they have determined that is you take a three-month child sitting on the child's mother's lap, and you show pictures of people of the same race as the child and different race as the child. And the child will look with considerably more interest and for a longer time at photographs of the children or black children. They are more likely to look with interest and spend more time looking at faces of their own race. Now, by the time children are 3 years old, they have a fairly sophisticated understanding of the significance and the persistence of race. And one experiment they've done along these lines is you take a picture of a little fat black boy in a police suit, and you say, here's Billy. And then you tell the child, this three-year-old child, I'm going to show you two pictures, and you tell me which of these is Billy all grown up. And one of the pictures is a fat white person in a police suit. And the other is a skinny black man in a bathing suit. By the time children are 3 years old, they know, they're not fooled by the fact that the white man is fat, that he's wearing a police suit just like little Billy. They know that when little Billy grows up, he's going to be the skinny black man in the bathing suit. They know that race is a permanent characteristic, an important characteristic. Another interesting test that has been done that just shows how deep wired into our psyche an appreciation of racial differences is if you take profiles of human beings, and these are profiles of just the first, you know, just the first part of the face, none of the back part, just the first part without the hair or anything, all jet black, and you take profiles of people of different races, different ages, the thing that people can most consistently distinguish is race. They can distinguish that more easily than sex or age to within about a 10-year span. It just goes to show you how deeply ingrained in our view of the world is a differentiation of who is like us and who is unlike us. Another interesting thing that has come up because of scientific advances is the result of brain studies that use magnetic resonance imaging, MRI it's called. With MRI, you can tell which parts of the brain are doing what. And there's a part of the brain called the fusiform region. And this fusiform region is very active when you are looking at something that you really understand well. If you take a bird watcher and you show him different kinds of birds, the fusiform region gets very active because he knows a lot about birds, is distinguishing between one kind of bird or another. And not surprisingly, if you take people and you show them photographs of faces, the fusiform region is much more active if you show them faces of their same race. They are distinguishing, they're categorizing. You show them faces of some other race, and the fusiform region is much less active. It's almost as inactive as showing pictures of animals, for example. Animals are interesting, but we do not have the same appraisal of distinguishing fine points between them the way we do with people of their own race. Another interesting thing that scientists have done is that they can take a photograph and what's called morph the photograph. On a computer, you can take the photograph and make subtle changes in it so that you could take a picture of somebody and make little changes so that it no longer looks exactly like that person but has a kind of a family resemblance. So the main features stay the same and they're based on that person's own features. What if you ask experimental subjects, you show them a whole list of photographs, they will almost invariably say that the person that appears the most trustworthy, the person they'd most like to know, is in fact the photograph that is based on their own face, slightly modified, to make it look like kind of a family resemblance. Another aspect of this aspect can be completely defeated if this morphed photograph that looks a little bit like, say, a long-lost cousin has then added a few little traits that make it suggest that it's another race person. Then the fact that it has these family resemblance features is completely canceled out, and that person becomes just as untrustworthy as any stranger. There's another almost funny example of just how much we are drawn to similarity rather than difference, and that is the way in which people choose their pets. If you take photographs of pet owners, dog owners, and purebred dogs that they have chosen to own, and you line all the photographs of the owners and the pets up, you will have a much, much better chance of pure randomness of drawing the owner and the pet together, pairing them up. Because when people get pets, they tend to end up with pets that look like themselves. I wish I had Phil Rushton of Canada has a whole slideshow about this. It's hilarious. You see these pictures of Pekingese and a lady. The similarities are just striking. But that just goes to show you how much we are drawn to similarity rather than to difference. There's another part of the brain that has been explored very, very intensively by means of this MRI business. It's called the amygdala. Well, the amygdala is the part of the brain that is involved with heightened awareness, worry, fear, concern, something might be going wrong. And if, for example, a great big grizzly bear were to break down that door and come snarling and growling into this room, every amygdala in this room would be going off like a... Well, once again, if you have this MRI going on, the scanning the brain, and you show people photographs of people of the same race, the different race, the amygdala is firing much more with people of a different race. We have this sort of heightened, we don't know what's coming, reaction to people of a different race. Amazingly enough, the amygdala can pick up things that you aren't even conscious of if this experiment is carried out by showing people photographs for only 30 microseconds. That's 30 thousandths of a second. That is so short a time that you're not even aware that you've seen what's in the picture. It's a little flash there. You don't know what it was. But your amygdala knows. It can tell the difference between a 30 microsecond exposure to a black face or a white face. And it has that same reaction even when you are unaware of what you have seen. It's that deeply wired into human nature. There's another very interesting experiment that some of you may have been familiar with, because it's one that you can actually go and take online. It was, they call it the Test for Unconscious Racism, and a bunch of people at Harvard worked on this thing. And I urge you to take it. You can find it on the internet with no trouble at all. And it starts out very easily. Good words and bad words. The good words are sort of obvious. Beautiful, generous, happy. And the bad words are, sickness, pestilence, crime, horror. And when you get a good word, you press one key. When you get a bad word, you press another key. Very simple. And you're told to press the keys as quickly and as accurately as possible. Then the next thing they do is they will show black faces on the screen and white faces, a mix. And when a black face comes up, you press one key. When white faces come up, you press another key. Very simple test. The next thing they do is they mix in black and white faces and good and bad words. And you're told, okay, whenever a white face and a good word comes up, press a key. When a black face and a bad word comes up, press a key. Well, white people are pretty good at that too. Well, what really stumps the white people who think that they are completely racially unconscious is when they switch it around and say, okay, when a black face and a good word comes up, press a one key. And when a white face and a bad word comes up, press the other key. Oh, white people are flummoxed by that. They have a very hard time doing that. In fact, 88% of white experimenters fail that test. And an amazing 12% apparently are able to distinguish, they'll press the black face and the good stuff just as consistently as they did the other way around. But 88% are much better at associating white faces with good things and black faces with bad things. And what the experimenters have found is that so many whites are mortified Oh, my gosh, you know, I thought I was an anti-racist. They're just terrified to discover that deep down inside they associate good things with white people. Now, another very interesting aspect of this is that a majority, a smaller majority, of black people also are better at associating good things with white people. 52% of blacks do that. Now, in a way, that shouldn't be too surprising. If you're a black person and you get shot at or mugged or cheated or beat up, chances are it's not going to be a Norwegian who did that to you. So these black test takers are reacting to the same kind of reality that white test takers are. But another very interesting difference, that 48% that actually managed to be better at associating blacks and good things, they're very proud of themselves. They say, great, well, of course, you know, I'm pleased. I'm associating good things with black people. Their reaction is completely the opposite to most whites, who think that they should be equally good at associating good things with black people. Now, I'll give you an example of just one more research study here. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens. You never read about these studies because they run completely in the face of what we're all taught to believe about things. But this is one in which what you do, there are a series of photographs of just faces again. And the faces differ by sex, race, and the color of the background. And so the experimental subject is given maybe 20 or 30 of these. And then he's paired with a partner. And the partner has just got one of that 20 or 30. And you are supposed to ask, in the smallest number of questions, a few little cues and clues to figure out which of those photographs the other person is holding. So obviously, it's very clear that the essential differences are sex, race, and color of background. So you should ask questions along those lines to figure out which is the photograph that your partner's holding. Well, what they found is that if the partner that you're paired with is black, only 10% of white people are willing to ask the obvious question, well, is it black or white? If they're paired with a white person, they're perfectly prepared to ask the obvious question. But white people are so nervous about race, so terrified that if they bring up race in any way with a black person, that will be misunderstood, that they stumble around, they ask about the background, they ask about the sex, but when it comes to race, oh my God, they dare not ask. Black people are very good at asking the obvious question. They're not inhibited by that. Now, something else. At what age would you guess white people get so intimidated about race that they stop asking the obvious question that will identify the picture? About 10 years old. This is an operation that it is obvious to 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, that if you're going to find out which picture the other person has, you ask about race. It's obvious. It's one of the things that makes it distinctive. White people stop asking the obvious question because they have learned that you just don't bring up this whole race business with black people. Well, I will read to you now some comments of two women, two white women, that I think are extremely illuminating. These are white women who have been brainwashed and bullied by the usual things that we all have to face, but then discovered, too late, in a very poignant and almost tragic way, just how much they had been deluded. This is written by a British woman who married for the second time to a dark-skinned man from India. She'd been married to a white man before, and she had two blonde-haired, blue-eyed children from her first marriage. Well, along comes the first child with husband number two, and she writes this: "When I turn to the mirror in my bedroom to admire us together, I am shocked. She seems so alien, with her long, dark eyelashes and shiny, dark brown hair. Me at all. I didn't realize how much her looking different would matter, and on a rational level, I know it shouldn't, but it does. Even admitting to having mixed feelings about her not being blonde and blue-eyed, I feel disloyal and incredibly guilty." That's a very sad story. Here's a woman who thought she was doing the right thing, but all of a sudden, her human nature has caught up to her where it really matters. Here's an American woman who badly wanted to have children could a baby from India. And she writes about how, well, you know, the fact that it's not a white baby, that shouldn't make a blind bit of difference. Okay, here's what she writes. Back home, after a couple of weeks had passed, I stared at Vaishali, that's the girl's name, Vaishali's naked bottom, her darkest part, and tried to ignore the insistent whispers of fear. Instead of brimming with pride, I felt like a trespasser. How could this be my daughter? I looked at her and I tried to find similarities between us. Relieved that her hair was straight, her lips not too full. Horribly ashamed. I tried to sort emotion from fact. Was it the dark color of her skin that was making me uncomfortable, or just that she did not look like me? Here's another woman. I no doubt she's a well-intentioned woman, thinking she's doing the right thing on the side of the angels, but when push comes to shove, her human nature comes back in the end, and she realizes, or at least she has some sense, that she has made a terrible mistake. Now, just imagine how our judges and bureaucrats and rulers, they will make decisions that will affect us in all sorts of ways. They are probably just like these two women. They have never had that visceral face-to-face contact with what it really means. Yet they integrate schools. They open our borders. They insist that we live with people who are unlike us. All of these people making decisions, I don't consider them evil for the most part. I think they probably think they're doing the right thing. But they are completely divorced from the real nature of who we are and what we've always been. When you get to this sense of wanting to be around people like yourself, it may seem extreme to us, but even deaf people and dwarves, they want to have children who are deaf or who are dwarves. This, to us, would be a terrible affliction to have a child who was deaf or who was a dwarf. But if adults are that way, they have such a drive to have similar children, similar to themselves, that they want their children to be like them, especially if it means being a dwarf or being deaf. Now, so far, I've been talking about individuals. What about societies? Well, as you can imagine, societies that are mixed have all kinds of conflicts that societies that are homogeneous do not. The primary scholar in this field is a man from Finland named Tatu Vanhanen. He's, in fact, the father of the current prime minister of Finland. But he has looked very, very carefully in societies all around the world, and no surprise, he's found that the more diverse the society in terms of race, ethnicity, religion, the more conflict you have. And it goes from very homogeneous places like Iceland or Japan, where there's practically no sectarian conflict, up to places like Lebanon or Sudan that have completely fallen apart because the conflict and the tension between all the mixtures of people. There is an American professor, Robert Putnam at Harvard, and many of you are probably familiar with his work. He became famous for having written a book called Bowling Alone. He did a study of 40 different communities in the United States that he chose very carefully, depending on how homogeneous they were, all the way out to how extremely diverse. He found that, needless to say, and this is something that any ordinary healthy American could have told him, whose mind was not clouded by an Ivy League education, that the more heterogeneous it was, the more conflict, the less trust there was going to be. Well, this, of course, is what Robert Putnam found. Well, he sat on his data for 2 years because he kept trying to figure out something other than diversity to explain for this. He sliced and diced the data to find out, well, maybe it has to do with household income, or maybe it has to do with how far people have to commute, or maybe it has to do with family size. He kept trying to think of some way to explain this lack of trust in these mixed communities that did not have to do with diversity. Well, finally, he did publish his results, and there was no way that he could jiggle the data and come up with any way to explain the real variable that mattered was ethnic and racial diversity. And these are the things he found. The more diverse the neighborhood, the lower the confidence in local government, local leaders, and local news media, the less likelihood to register to vote, a less expectation that neighbors would cooperate to solve problems, less likelihood to work on a community project, volunteer, or give to charity, having fewer closer friends and confidants, less happiness, less perceived quality of life, less likely to carpool, and more time spent watching television, and more likely to say, television is my most important form of entertainment. What people do is, if they're in an area full of folks unlike themselves, they just pull into themselves. They're not part of their community anymore. They don't trust their surroundings. Whereas when people are in communities very much like themselves, all of those things go in reverse. They trust their communities and they contribute to their communities. Well, none of this, of course, has persuaded Robert Putnam that diversity is not a good thing. He just says, well, okay, maybe in the short term that seems to be a problem, but I'm convinced that in the long term it's just going to be great. Well, gosh, is he whistling past the graveyard? Does he really believe this? I don't know. But that's the official view. It may be a problem in the short term. This whole question of social trust has become so well understood that there is a name for it. It's called the Florida effect. And the Florida effect has to do with the fact that in Florida, you have a lot of retired white people and a whole lot of young Hispanic people and black people. Well, the older white people are not willing to vote for bond issues or raise their taxes for education. They don't really want to educate and pay taxes for folks that are not their own grandchildren. Whereas in states like Maine, Vermont, West Virginia, where there is a greater amount of racial homogeneity, the older generation is willing. Those are the states that contribute the largest part of gross state product to youth-oriented education, that kind of thing. Because people are prepared. They're happy to pay for people that they are that are their kinfolk. Now, this kind of attachment to one's own kind and one's own kin, science and research of this kind is found all over the world. People cooperate with people who are like themselves, and they are suspicious of people who are different. Now, a promoter of diversity might think that all I have done is cherry-pick the research that suggests that diversity is a bad thing, that I've ignored mountains of data that would suggest that diversity is wonderful and splendid like we're all supposed to believe. I mean, surely all these people are not saying this without any evidence at all. Well, the evidence that the proponents of diversity point to is a book that's very famous in certain quarters. It's by a fellow named Scott Page of the University of Michigan. And it has a very promising title from their point of view. The book is called The Difference: How the Power of Diversity Creates Better Groups, Firms, Schools, and Societies. Sounds like they've got a man in their corner, doesn't it? Well, if you actually read this book, what he's talking about is different intellectual approaches to things. He says, for example, if you need to solve some kind of industrial problem, you might need somebody who knows something about finance, you might need somebody who knows science, you might need somebody who's a mathematician. That is what he's talking about. He's not talking about racial and ethnic diversity. In fact, he is an honest enough scholar so that when it comes to the whole question of racial and ethnic diversity, this is what he writes. Lots of strange things can happen in a diverse group that would not be likely to happen among homogeneous people, including physical and verbal violence. He says the more different we are, the less we agree on what we should do. He says group dynamics under these circumstances create no end of problems. People prefer to hang out with people like themselves. All very basic, obvious stuff. But the people who are promoting diversity ignore this aspect of the book, and I've heard several people promote this book as proving their point that diversity is such a wonderful and great thing. I sometimes say that the whole idea that diversity of that kind is a strength is so obviously wrong and stupid that only very, very intelligent people could possibly persuade themselves it was true. Well, take Bill Clinton. I suppose you can't be president of the United States without being, if you're entirely stupid. But just this month, I'm sure many of you saw, in some speech to a group of Arab Americans, he was once again telling us how great it's going to be when white people become a minority. He said, by the middle of the century, white people will be down to 49% of the population. And then this is his quote. Quote, "This is a very positive thing," says Bill Clinton. Well, I'd like to ask Bill sometime, okay, 49%, that's a positive thing, huh? Well, at what point does it cease to be positive? When we're 30%? When we're 15%? When we're 0%? At what point are white people allowed to say, well, hold on here, we don't really want to fade away after all? Well, Bill Clinton is not the only guy who talks this way. In fact, all around the world, white people, and only white people, seem to think they've perfectly reconciled the idea of just glimmering away. Here's Charles Price. He's Australia's senior demographer, he's called. In 2000, he was talking about the fact that all these Asians are immigrating into Australia. He says, some people think that a steady replacement of Anglo-Celts by other ethnic groups is highly desirable. And personally, replacement doesn't worry me at all. And here, Joseph Ritson, he's the Dutch Minister of Education, Culture, and Science. Some years ago, he said, this is the trend worldwide. The white race will in the long term become extinct. And apparently, we are happy with this development. Well, Joseph Ritson is wrong. We're not happy about this development. In fact, we're hopping mad about this. The Council of Conservative Citizens is hopping mad about this. Everyone in this room is hopping mad about this. And we think that people who talk like that are fools, suicidal fools, and we have had enough of it. And so my message to you today is that when you go forth and you fight for your people, for your heritage, for your country, for your God, that what you're doing is not simply in accordance with history and human nature and everything we know about the way human beings are. Even the scientists have figured out that it is part of our deep, essential human nature. And it's something that you owe to your ancestors, and even more so to your descendants. They have no choice but to live in the world that we make for them. When our ancestors fought for independence from Britain, they weren't fighting for diversity. And when our ancestors fought for an independent Southland, they weren't fighting for multiculturalism. Even the men who fought for the Union weren't fighting for that. They were fighting for their people and for their race. It's our generation that broke faith. But I think we're waking up. The Council of Conservative Citizens is helping Americans wake up. We have nationalist parties all over Europe who are helping white people wake up. And eventually there'll come a time when all people, even our own deluded people, will realize that we have the right to be us, and only we can be us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Please visit the Council of Conservative Citizens website at cofcc.org. And be sure to check out the lineup of hosts at Voice of Reason Radio at reasonradionetwork.com.